From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Joey asks Aaron about if maybe we're thinking about Kanye wrong, and Aaron asks Joey about depressed futurists.
Woo! By the way, this is what a Joey sounds like.
And this is what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what an ultra magnificent Jess sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess. Okay.
So,
That was the theme song.
Yeah.
That was the theme song.
The theme song just happened and it's incredible and click, 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 Ooh. Click. I'm actually really excited about this question because I've been thinking about it quietly by myself all summer.
Thanks for building it up, man.
Yeah. So my question to you, Aaron, is,
Ooh.
Are we thinking about Kanye all wrong?
Yeah, why?
So here's my thing. I think I'm going to start with a hot take. I think that Kanye West's album, Ye, and the Kid Cudi Kanye West album, Kids See Ghosts, combined as one album, front to back, is the most important album of the year.
Okay. Oh, my. Oh, wow. Okay. We're going to have a talk about this. Wow.
So here's the thing. Obviously, Kanye is a specimen, right? There's a lot of reasons why we can be upset with Kanye or angry with Kanye, or, you know, the things that he says often are impolitic, let's say.
Oh, that's so kind to say it that way.
Yeah.
And so kind to say that. Yeah, no.
Yeah. But this set of albums, right? And it kind of fundamentally adds up to, it's a 14-track album if you listen to Ye and then Kids See Ghosts back to back. So it is sort of a traditional LP length. Feels like the best treatise that I've ever listened to on mental health and cognitive diversity. And what's interesting about it is you took two people who have bipolar disorder and have had struggles with mental health. You put them alone in the woods in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they produced an album. And what's sort of interesting about it is the fact that, like, normally these people, if they're struggling with mental health issues or whatever, are in a studio with other neurotypical people who don't necessarily relate. And there's something about putting them together, building these two albums, and, like, feeding into each other, and all of a sudden not being sort of like the token, you know, cognitive diverse people in the room, that all of a sudden they make something, I think, that's kind of incredible.
I mean, okay, we have to break this down. Because I think that Kanye is a genius. I truly think that he is at that level of artistry where his impact on hip hop, on music over the past 15 or so years has been seismic. Like, he's had the biggest impact on hip hop of any artist that we've had in that time frame.
And I think you can say impact without necessarily having to agree that he is, like, the best artist of the past 15, but he's still had the most impact, I
absolutely
think.
Absolutely. Because his style, he is a part of a wave of hip hop that was all about the producer. You had, like, Timbaland, you had Kanye, you had a number of other producers who were making tracks for lots of other people that had their own sonic signature. And that sort of bled into not just all of those different artists' music, but then fed into all of the genres that those featured artists were in. And it reshaped pop music. And then it also reshaped hip hop and what hip hop sounds like. Not even to get into a conversation about the fact that hip hop is actually pop music and that that's a terrible designation for music. We'll save that for a different conversation.
Yeah.
Separate from that, I think the question about whether Kanye's album is the most important of the year is very interesting, in that from a musicality perspective, I would challenge that. I mean, Carrie Underwood launched Cry Pretty this week. That's up there. That's a personal favorite. No, I think that there are three different elements to the Kanye story where you cannot unlink an artist from their context. The music, the person, and the conversations that he has, right?
Yeah.
Because I feel like what you're saying is that the person himself and what he created alongside Kid Cudi as they were going through this experience, or not through this experience, but explaining their experience, was really valuable to us this year. And it hit us in a way that we haven't ever heard before.
Well, I would argue that we're not actually even having the conversation about neurodiversity or mental health publicly. It's not one that I've at least been hearing when people are talking about Kanye. It's a question of like, what's wrong with him, or he's fucked up, or he's crazy, right? Like things that you would, you know, in our society broadly, which is trying to be more tolerant, I mean, to varying degrees of success, but it seems that the general momentum is to be more tolerant. But we're talking about mental health in all the wrong ways. And what you saw leading up to the release of what amounted to five critically pretty widely accepted albums, actually Ye was probably the least acclaimed of the albums that came out when he went into this like studio binge in Jackson Hole for like a month. No one's talking about, so leading up to that, right, he's on TMZ, he's like saying things about Donald Trump, whatever, but from someone who, you know, I'm not a psychologist, I don't pretend to be an expert, but I
to be an expert, just in different ways.
I'm currently wearing a lab coat.
There's a Bunsen burner in the background with an Erlenmeyer flask. So I had to say Erlenmeyer.
Touche. But I studied neuroscience and psychology, and so there are things that were happening leading up to that that to me looked just like Kanye was in a manic episode. Like it seemed he's talked about not wanting to take his medication in the past or like struggling with things like that, and everything about it to me read like a manic episode. And then he went into the studio, right? Yeah. And as a culture, there has been a lot of over the past like 75,000 years, like the introduction of tolerance to neurodiversity has created a ton of huge leaps forward.
Yeah. Also, pause for a sec. Can you explain what you mean by neurodiversity? Because I, at least on a technical level, but also just how you're thinking about that.
Yeah. So neurodiversity is sort of the idea of inclusion of people with effectively like different wiring schemes of how their brain functions, right? And so that includes things like ADHD, schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder, dyslexia, things like that, where your brain is not processing certain types of information in the same way. And all of, you know, those disorders are fundamentally different, but they all represent sort of brain wirings that are outside of normal. Right.
I'm glad you put finger quotes on normal, because normal doesn't exist.
Yeah, so in the people who have sort of started the neurodiversity movement, and I think it arose out of high-functioning autistic people who were kind of wanting to be included in normal conversation, in quotes again, they use the term neurotypical or neurodiverse. But in this case, Kanye has bipolar disorder. Kid Cudi has very publicly struggled with his mental health issues, much more self-aware than Kanye is. But that's also part of what's interesting about this album is if you listen to the Kanye album, it seems like you're sort of watching someone in the throes of the struggle, right? I mean, literally the first track is talking about premeditated murder. Mm-hmm. And but what's interesting about it is he's not trying to hide it.
Right.
He's saying things like, if I was trying to relate it to more people, I'd say something like, I'm struggling to love myself right now, but that's not it. Today I thought about killing you. And it's just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like it's just so open that it's jarring to me. I get emotional when I listen to it.
Yeah. And not to flatten it, but it is a part of a bigger moment that we're having around acknowledgement of mental health, period. As a I think in a way that we've not embraced it before, because we've had there are so many studies that actually point to the rise in anxiety as a mass epidemic within not just America but many other countries as well, and that is not surprisingly bleeding over into pop culture in a way. Mm-hmm. Like we're hearing about artists, traditional pop artists, coming out and being very public with their fans about what they're struggling with. And I mean, this is all also dovetailing with sort of unprecedented levels of transparency when it comes to entertainment. Mm-hmm. Like, you can go on Instagram and every other social media scheme and effectively feel like you're talking to Demi Lovato every day. Again, not that that's me, I swear. Love you, Demi. But I think that that sort of thing is, it's not just relatable. It's something that has been hidden in the closet that mm-hmm. now more and more people are recognizing and seeing themselves in others and seeing themselves in their idols, mm-hmm. if we want to call pop stars and musicians, I should say, and artists idols. And it's nice that this is specifically coming from Black men. Like, yeah. I can't, it's a part of the conversation in the Black community that is so complicated.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's Kanye that's coming out about this, it, complicated as well.
Well, the interesting part is, like, he is coming out about it, but he's not really talking about it. Like, that's the weird part of it. Like, Kid Cudi talks about it. And what I think is interesting is that the front album, where you're sort of watching Kanye, like, go through some crazy shit, and the lines in it are very, like, telling and raw and unfiltered and sort of incredible. That if you consider the back half of the album, the Kids See Ghosts album, there's a self-awareness there that Kid Cudi brings in where it becomes the mirror, mm-hmm. right? Like, you're looking at what the problem is. And I think that part of it is interesting. But Kanye, like, on the album title says something like, I'm pulling it up right now. I hate being bipolar. It's awesome. Right? Like, that is, I think, there, and there's like one or two quotes in or lyrics in the songs that bring it up, but otherwise he's not fully talking about it. That's like, I want to have the discussion about whether we should stop viewing Kanye as like another celebrity, right? Where you view him equivalently to, you know, LeBron or Carrie Underwood or Ellen or whoever, these like larger than life celebrities, and instead view him as someone who has mental health disorders and creates beautiful art, and that it's okay to still have his art be beautiful if you don't agree with everything he says. And that message from the Medium conversation is sort of weird. Like, you don't want to label Kanye as like, you're bipolar, therefore you're in this own bucket. He's still a person and all of that. But, you know, if people are like, you can't like his album because he said fucked up shit, or he loves Trump and his dragon energy or whatever it is, that, you know, I feel like without labeling him, we still need to be able to say, like, it's okay that he's seeing the world very differently than us, but he's still making beautiful art.
Joey, you're talking about nuance. People don't do well with nuance. Yeah,
we don't do nuance.
No, we do really, really strong bucketing. But I also think that we have a problem with recognizing that that sort of, or the artistic merit, could actually be a result of that aspect exactly. of who he is. Like, it's inextricable from what he produces
yeah.
and what he creates and what ended up being Kanye's workout plan. Like yeah. that was, he was going through all of this when he was talking about, when he had, help me, Blonde, Trim Spa.
Oh.
Anna Nicole Smith. There we go.
Oh, Anna Nicole. I was thinking of Amber Rose.
I was thinking Anna Nicole Smith because she's in the music video for Kanye's okay. workout plan. Anyway, that sort of creativity in and of itself, I think, is something that we have trouble as humans truly appreciating what it means.
Like, yeah.
The act of creation is something that is inherently not just novel, but in something that's not existed before. It's reconstituting elements in a way that creates something bigger than its previous elements.
Yeah.
And Kanye has done that from Through the Wire all the way through this album, like yeah. and through the records on there.
Yeah, I mean, arguably 808s and Heartbreaks, he was publicly going through the depressive side of bipolar disorder yes. and still producing, which is sort of an interesting component, right? Like, he was deeply depressed and he produced 808s and Heartbreaks. And now in Ye, he's in like a wild manic stage.
Yeah.
But I think like the point that you brought up about it's inextricable from the art, like his mental health is why he's producing this incredible work that I think is respectable. And there's some Kanye that I like Life of Pablo and Yeezus, I personally don't really like. I like most of his stuff. Those albums were like a select few songs, but there's this concept that where I mentioned 75,000 years ago before, you know, as if you guys number. Are just all have it on your calendar.
I do.
Yeah. There's this concept called the Great Leap Forward, and a lot of scientists and anthropologists, you know, and I don't think it's like a widely agreed upon concept, but a lot of people believe that humans took the Great Leap Forward as a society in part because of acceptance and tolerance of neurodiversity. And one of the examples they give is that people with autism are particularly good at tool production, right? Like being able to do repeated tasks over and over again and be extremely detail-oriented and systematic about the approach to building things. So whether that's arrowheads or using tools or building buildings or whatever, the ability for society to tolerate them while being different created, you know, something new in society that made it better. And the same thing goes for people with bipolar disorder or depression being artists, and people with ADHD being like characters and actors and sort of charisma and things like that. And I think that makes sense, and we do tolerate them. But what's interesting is in the public eye, we don't, right? Like if you look at someone like Van Gogh, who whiled away his whole life producing incredible art, but none of it was sort of accepted or viewed in the way it is now until after he died, because he was such, you know, he was actively struggling with his mental health issues, and it was hard to be around him. And so you couldn't separate those ideas. And so now we're at a point where we're like, Kanye is getting his music out there and it's incredible, but he has these mental health issues, and we're actively saying like, is it okay or not?
Well, what's so funny is that we're still struggling, not struggling, but the language drives us to a certain place too, like mental health. So we're talking a lot about it being a symptom, it being sickness, which is a way for, or which originally was a way for us to start talking about people as people, not as afflictions. But we, at the same time, still really struggle with getting close to sick people.
Yeah.
And if we've designated them as sick, then that conflicts with our other innate challenge with just being accepting.
Right.
Because we, as humans, we also have a little bit of a problem with both tolerance and acceptance. Like, that's not something that I think we've ever done quite well. But I mean, it goes back to your question, which was about whether we're judging Kanye incorrectly, whether we're judging him incorrectly. And I think that that's really right, because it's a question about not just are we judging his output correctly, because the output is inextricably linked. I love me some inextricably linked to the man itself.
Right.
So if that's the case, do we not just need to reconsider how we're relating and judging Kanye, but how we judge each other?
Oh, shit.
I almost made a poop noise, but I won't do that in the microphone. So I think we've answered it, though. I think the answer is judge unto others as you would have judged unto you.
There it is. Yeah. I think I would just end this with saying, if you have listened to the album and you're willing to go back, I think listen to it through that lens of what Kid Cudi and Kanye are going through, and be able to have a conversation. Because I think that's part of it, right? Being able to still have Kanye in the public sphere means that we have to be able to say, like, when he goes off on Dragon Energy tangents, or he, you know, writes 300 tweets in a day that are like four words that seem incoherent, that's a product of who he is and what he's going through. And if we can have a public conversation about Kanye having mental health issues, then we don't have to worry about whether he's saying things that we like don't want our kids to learn, or whatever people, you know, wherever they're having issues with the things that he's saying, especially, right, like, we don't have to get into it, but the things that he's been saying about slavery are obviously problematic, to put it lightly. So go back, listen to the album through the lens of what Kanye's going through, and I think it changes the experience.
And with that, we're going to be right back. Oh. hey, we're back. And we had a deep breath that you all had to slide in on like a ruby slippered carpet.
Yeah.
Alongside Aladdin and Jasmine. I did it.
Now that we got through the light stuff.
Oh, yeah. It feels like a nice parka from Montclair.
Yeah, we just started with real surface level topical humor.
It's
now
true.
Let's get to the deep stuff.
Yeah, and actually it's going to dovetail shockingly well. So I'm in a book club and we spend a lot of time reading sci-fi. I'm sure that's not surprising at all.
And I'm not invited?
Yeah, well, maybe both of you and Jess should be invited, especially with the faces that we're getting from Super Leader Jess right now.
Can I just say for a second that I observed yesterday... No, I... proclaimed yesterday that I'm pretty confident everyone in New York who has any kind of satisfying social life is part of some incredible book club that they hold very close to the vest. And this is not something that everyone makes, you know, this is not a publicly known fact, but once you get to know New Yorkers, you're like, oh, everyone's part of a book club. Like, how do I get one of those?
Yeah.
It's very secret.
This is why I'm not satisfied with my life.
That's right.
Now I know.
That's the explanation.
Get your books, bruh.
Yeah.
Anyway, I will say, by the way, the answer to that is make your book club, because that's what we did.
Yeah.
But in our book club, we're reading a lot in sort of the Isaac Asimov era and some Ray Bradbury and that sort of thing. And even though you had so much being discussed in that lens that was about the future as... perhaps a scary place, because that's really where sci-fi was being born out of this.
Yeah, dystopian futures, right?
Bingo. There was still so much optimism and hope. Like, that's the same time that you're seeing the Jetsons on TV. Or like, this kind of amazement about what could be possible almost felt like it saturated more so than the dystopic narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to today, or I should say, within the book club, in contrast, what we're talking about with futurists today... You look around and basically we believe that all cities are going to be overcrowded hovels with hundreds of people who do not have any money. Hundreds of thousands of people who are divided into haves and have nots and were basically in the Hunger Games.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, why are futurists so depressed?
Yeah, it's... I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons, right? I think... that something that might coincide with what you're talking about was the movement in extreme near future fiction, right? And I think a lot of that had to do with how much our society is changing at once, right? The acceleration of change is pretty incredible. And there are sort of a couple of imminent threats that we're sitting on the precipice of right now, climate change being the biggest of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of like looking really close, like further than you could actively do something about today, but not that far out with this looming threat of climate change. I think those two movements together result in, oh shit.
Yeah.
That sort of collective, like, little bit of poop in the pants.
Just a touch. Just a touch. I think you're right. I think that there are always a series of threats, though, that are wrapped around science fiction that are then refracted through the medium.
Mm-hmm.
So even in the 50s, when you had a dystopic future that was being articulated, it was often steeped with a little bit of Cold Warism.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a touch of that starting to like kind of get in there. And what's weird, too, is that if you go to the 80s, you start to see... 80s and 90s, you definitely see some more of that dystopic storytelling about a dangerous, scary future, and almost like the tutelage of fear where we're going, that whole thing, the Margaret Atwood Oryx and Crake-ness of it, even though that was a lot later.
Yeah, but a lot of that had to do with sort of like be aware of this possible outcome to avoid it, which I think is different than like the depression that you're talking about, right?
That's fair, because then it was very much, and it was a story, there were stories, fables almost, that were intended to help impact.
Yeah, they were like warnings.
Behavior. They were warnings. They were the canaries in the coal mine. Caw-caw, caw-caw. Canaries don't caw-caw.
We needed animal noises on this.
We did. Whereas today, I do feel, and I do want to flag, like, I think depressed is the wrong word because, I mean, after we just had a conversation about mental health, it's kind of
pessimistic,
unfair.
Maybe, right?
Pessimistic is more accurate. When you're thinking about why there is such pessimism, it is steeped with not just climate change, but the social realities of what we've gone through also recently are more globally upheaving than many have experienced in our lifetimes, or at least in the past 30 years, not in our lifetimes collectively. Yeah.
There's an aspect of this that I think that you have to place the person who's doing the writing within the context of the culture that they exist in, mm-hmm. and sort of like what are the omnipresent ideas, right? And so right now, I think within the US, there's sort of a pretty incredible polarizing conflict around almost any idea. And so the inability to agree, I think, about simple things, about mm-hmm. complicated things, right? Like everything from climate change to gun control to whether schools should be public or charter, right? Like mm-hmm. independent of how I feel about any of those things, people don't agree. And there's sort of like a pretty clear, almost 50-50 divide on a lot of these subjects. Yeah. And so that impasse, I think, creates like, we're never going to be able to do anything about anything because we can't decide, we can't agree on the simple things.
It's the intractability of those debates right now that perhaps generates that sentiment of, there's no upside. Like, we can't see a resolution. And so therefore, what happens in a future where there is no resolution, not just to those issues at a social level, but also when it comes at a political level, when we have log jams in the US, in the House and the Senate, and the Senate is supposed to be the saucer upon which the tea is cooled, according to Alexander Hamilton. And that's why it was 6 years that they were going to have their term limits.
Yeah.
And yet here we are, and they're at a logjam. It really does boil down into really, really fun movies with Katniss Everdeen,
yeah.
and books that, interestingly enough, allow that intractability to be boiled down to what teenagers can identify with mm-hmm. as young adult books,
right?
Which is scary. The fact that we're actually we have popularized and started to train a younger generation, both, I think, as, you know, beware what could happen, but also get used to it because this is kind of what's going to happen.
Yeah, but I think if you still view them through the lens of a warning in those cases, you know, in the case of the Hunger Games, right, it is sort of a push against opulence and government overreach. I don't know.
Has and have nots as well. Yeah, I mean, truly, when you also have class divides and mm-hmm. Inequitable distribution of wealth and what that actually results in. Yeah. And a lot of reports are looking at 2030 and 2050 and saying, we actually need to look at the labor market because we're going to have a completely different labor market because there is a broader distribution of mm-hmm. broader gap in the distribution of wealth.
Yeah, I think what's interesting when it comes back to the culture, right, like America is facing that issue more than any other developing nations, right? There's an expansion of the middle class globally, but then there is a shrinking middle class in America. And I think this idea too of what the interesting ideas within science fiction coming out of different cultures, tying to those cultures. There was a book a few years ago by, it was actually a trilogy by a guy named Shishin Liu in China, and it kind of caught on really big. And fundamentally, the ideas within it are around sort of fearing the outside, right? Mm. The outside in this case being like any other intelligent species within the universe. And that idea ties back into what's happening within the Chinese culture and the communist government and how they're promoting the idea of like, you should be scared of other nations because they don't believe what we believe and they're lying and they're torturing everyone and everything is terrible, right? Like that idea has sort of been pervasive since the Cultural Revolution in the 70s. And so that fear of outside cultures all of a sudden, you know, the book is hard sci-fi. It makes a very intelligent case that we should be scared of every other alien species in the universe. And instead of looking for them, we should be hiding. Mm-hmm. But it ultimately just ties back to the culture that concept was born out of, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a globalist societies, the books about outer space are saying like, go out, connect, we'll create a federation with other, right? Like Star Trek was born out of the US and Three Body Problem and mm-hmm. and The Dark Forest, which is the second book, come out of China's fear of the outside.
And what's interesting about that example, not the Star Trek example, but the Xianlu example, is that it coincides with overall nationalism sentiments. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that's not just born out of, while certainly that is something that's been really, really powerful within China, this sort of fear or looking out and saying, wait, no, there's danger out there. That's been what we've started to see everywhere over the past five or six years. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's only just when we've been seeing it. That means that it's been growing for decades.
Yeah.
It's been growing, you know, as these sci-fi writers were growing up and basically got to a point where they could crystallize that entire experience into this terrifying, terrifying future that we all live in. I mean, all I know is that I am excited for the Hyperloop. I'm excited to go from New York to Shanghai in a day, maybe New York to London or London to Shanghai. I think we could do that with sort of like high space, you know, air travel, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's opportunity. And it's weird because I think that part of our job is to be aware of the pessimism mm-hmm. and to remind that we actually need companies to be stewards of optimism.
Right.
Because they're the ones who hold the purse strings to actually make the future something that people can look forward to.
Well, what's interesting as we're wrapping this thing up is I think, especially within the conversation that we were just having about neurodiversity, right? Like there is potentially some sort of homeostatic aspect to what we're talking about with this optimism, pessimism, where there was a lot of optimism for a while and we were just going gung-ho at things, right?
True.
If you're thinking about the internet revolution and, you know, the sort of high times of the 90s and the 2000s and everything was going well, there sort of needs to be some sort of counteraction to that. And there's like a benefit to these warnings of people writing books and saying like, this is a possibility, right? Like sure. There's a couple books over the past few years that have won Hugos and Nebulas, where, you know, one of them was by, we'll put it in the show notes, but it was fundamentally around like the efflorescence of culture of like, we burned up all of the natural resources and we didn't do anything to come up with alternative energy solutions and everything burned out. And I think like that was a warning because at that point when the book came out, we're just like, the internet's awesome. Everything's going to be solved. It's great. And, and someone, you kind of be like, hey guys, one thing that I was thinking about is that the internet takes energy and if we don't have any, then
that's a problem.
Yeah.
So then you're,
I don't get any likes.
So then your answer to the question of, you know, why futurists are so pessimistic is basically, it's okay. Just wait. There will be another Robbie Williams album out with Millennium on it in due time. Just wait it out.
As long as I'm getting more Robbie Williams, I want the Love Actually story to mm-hmm. work with Robbie Williams, where he comes back and does a Halloween song.
Oh yes, that could work for me.
Yeah,
I think we cracked it.
Yeah, I mean, again, solved two major societal issues. Second episode. I mean, this is a great track record. We're batting 1,000.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sports.
Oh, wait until we get into some more sports conversation. That's gonna
slam
be good.
Dunk.
Slam dunk. Yes, converse and prosper, dear friends. We'll see you next time.
Jess approves.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. This has been Critical Nonsense. Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
Our executive producer is attendance award winner Jess Vander.
And our sound engineer is Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank a lot of people, mostly Kanye West, for all those text messages.
Ray Bradbury for Bradburying All About.
Kid Cudi for Never Growing Up.
Carrie Underwood for Crying So Pretty.
And Aaron Powers for being powerful.
And Joey K. Meyer for being K-Myrical.
We did it. We did it again. This is just nonstop.
Hey,
you line them up, we knock them down.
Knock them down. It's baseball. It's skee ball. It's sports.